Chapter 3, Israel Born, Palestine Destroyed. You know, Hisham, thinking back, by the end of World War II, the Zionist movement had grown so much in power and influence since it was born in the latter years of the 19th century, and the Jewish population of Palestine had grown tremendously as well. Now, the Jewish story is really quite well known in the U.S. and Europe. Everything from the Exodus ship to all the articles to the Holocaust. But the Palestinian perspective, even now, is not all that well known. Now, you were born into this conflict. You're born in a refugee camp. I think it was in 63, was it?
That's correct.
So right from the beginning, you're a refugee born into, at the time, it was a part of Jordan. The Six-Day War was a few years off. So as you now think back and as you've studied and learned from your family and learned from the Palestinians, what at the time of World War II and in the years just before Israel was born, where was the Palestinian community coming from? What was going on with them? What were they thinking and planning and doing?
As we have stated earlier, Mark, during the 1940s, there was a tremendous shock on the part of the Palestinians, a great deal of disappointment due to the fact that the 1936-1939 Palestinian rebellion against the Zionist movement and the British mandate did not succeed its objectives. Furthermore, there was a great deal of pain caused by the fact that during that rebellion, there was an intra-Palestinian leadership crisis. There was an unfair competition, so to speak.
Hisham, just a little joke here. Are we talking about the current period, or are we talking about the period in the 1940s? Leadership crisis, dejection.
That's exactly the point. Exactly. I mean, you know, talking about 1936 sounds like talking about 2036. I hope not, but at least certainly it's like talking about 20. You know.
As you said that,
and
as you said that, my vision was, oh, leadership crisis among the Palestinians. Oh, they're dejected because their rebellion hadn't worked and everything was going against them. Well, it sounds like, oh, Oslo didn't work. Oh, the Intifadas didn't work. Oh, gee, we've got the leadership crisis between Hamas and Fatah. So history hasn't changed all that much in some ways.
Unfortunately not. And in retrospect, I would even go as far as saying that one of the main reasons why that great rebellion did not succeed in achieving its objectives was because of the leadership crisis then. And the very same thing can be said today, unfortunately, that the Palestinian uprisings, whether the one in 1987 or the one in 2000, to a great extent, could not achieve their objectives because the Palestinian leadership, in my view, did not do what it should have done to enable such uprisings to succeed. And more recently, of course, there has been a profound leadership crisis in Palestinian society due to the contestation between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. At any rate,
well, back to the 40s, what was happening among the Palestinians? What did they try to do as World War II came to an end, as the UN was being born, and as they must have known there was going, refugees were coming and flooding Palestine, and the Zionist movement was threatening to declare an independent state?
Absolutely. During the 1940s, a period of attempted recovery from the shock of 1936-1939, shock caused by the increase in Jewish immigration into the country, and also by the mounting pressure done by the British. They had built most of their prisons then to incarcerate Palestinians. There were torture chambers, many Palestinians killed. Yes, there were internal and external causes, I think, which have converged to cause the state of frustration and anguish among Palestinians. And I think the Zionist movement clearly understood that, against the backdrop of the low morale in Palestinian society, there was a high degree of preparation in the Zionist movement. Yes, one has to be fair and say that Palestinians were preparing to resist the Zionist project to colonize Palestine. There was some Palestinian resistance on the ground. There were some very decent, dignified national leaders among Palestinians, like, for example, you know, one of the names that usually comes to mind all the time is Abdul Qadir al-Husseini. He is from, you know, the same family as that of Haj Amin. Actually, he's a very, very close relative of Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Palestine. But Abdul Qadir was indeed said to have led some very fierce resistance against the Zionist intruders. But by and large, the resistance was not as strong as the Zionist movement was preparing. It was somewhat disorganized. There were popular committees to prepare. But when the Zionists really were adamant or became determined to take over the country, I think there was a great deal of asymmetry of power between Palestinians and the Zionists. So,
Hisham, what was the status of the idea of the two-state solution at the time? You know, we've talked about the Peel Commission, we've talked about the original birth of the two-state solution. Was there much interest, discussion of the two-state solution at that time in any circles?
That was my next point indeed. So in 1947, as the British handed over the question of Palestine to the United Nations, and as the United Nations General Assembly finally, under severe pressure, ominous pressure from the United States on a number of countries, passed Resolution 181 to partition Palestine on November 29, 1947, Palestinians were absolutely caught by shock and by incredible surprise. They felt that that idea of dividing up their country was unjust and for a number of reasons. Number one, they were never consulted. Number two, they felt that this was a grave violation of their right to self-determination on their own territory, in their own country. And number three, the nature of the division was so unfair to the extent that the 30% Jewish community, much of it was, of course, illegal immigrants, got 56% out of the land of Palestine by the partition resolution, while the 70% of the population who are Palestinians, Christians and Muslims, and only received 43% of the country. And add to that the fact that the 30% Jewish community received the best of the land, the most fertile, the most strategic, the coastal, the most beautiful land, and the 70% received the desolate, inland territory. So there was a feeling that this was not just. Justice was not really delivered to the Palestinians, and therefore Palestinians, you know, attempted to resist.
Okay, now
movements, Zionist groups were preparing, in spite of that, to take over the country, and they unleashed a number of Zionist terrorist organizations like the Stern Gang and the Irgun, which committed a number of massacres against Palestinians to instill fear, to drive Palestinians out of their towns and villages. One of the most famous massacres was in April of 1948 in the village of Deir Yassin in the Jerusalem area, where all the inhabitants of that village, and as the story goes, even the cattle, were killed and dropped in a well in the village. And the massacre was committed in a very, very bloody way. And there are actually incredible narratives from some observers, including somebody from the Red Cross, who saw the ominous killing, who saw how the Irgun and the Stern Gang, led by Shamir and Begin, participated in the massacre of those villagers. And
well,
that
Hisham,
was not the only case.
Hisham, in a sense, using today's terminology, this was the ethnic cleansing and this was the terror of the time. It had political goals associated with it. And as you say, the leaders who perpetrated it then became the major leaders of Israel, the Zionist movement, the revisionist Zionist movement, and the settler movement. Did the Palestinian population at the time feel the Arab states were going to prevent this from happening? What was the relationship between Palestine and the Arab states at that time? And was the expectation is, gee, we're not going to let this happen, and they're not going to let this happen?
Well, as I said, there were a number of massacres. Finally, Israel was declared a state, the middle of May of 1948. The Truman administration hastened to recognize Israel, only 11 minutes after its declaration of independence. And there was the 1948 war. Now, quite frankly, there were hopes and desires by the Palestinians that the Arabs would come to their aid. But in actuality, Palestinians were well aware of the fact that the Arab armies, which came supposedly to help the Palestinians, did not do so. They were sent only as a show of support by the Arab leaders, who were concerned about the anger of their own public opinion against their rule if they did not come to the help of the Palestinians. In other words, whether in Egypt or in Jordan, King Farouk was never interested in any real support of the Palestinians whatsoever. After all, he was a puppet of the British. In Jordan, the Arab Legion, which came to supposedly to help Palestinians, was led by the British army officer, Gleb Pasha, who absolutely had the interests of Israel and Zionism at heart and not the interests of the Palestinians, and Palestinians narrated that those armies, especially the Arab Legion, as a matter of fact, did more to help Israel rather than to harm it. Some of these armies participated in liquidating Palestinian resistance and in preventing Palestinians from resisting the new arrangements that were created. And there are stories upon stories upon stories which were told in this regard. And now we do know, based on a more careful review of the historical record, that yes, there was an ethnic cleansing. One of the best works that were written was by Eran Pape, who is an Israeli professor, who wrote a book called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. We do know also from the record that the Arab Legion and other Arab armies, as a matter of fact, did more to harm Palestinian resistance, to put it under siege, and to destroy the remnants of Palestine, more so than to help them. Therefore, in 1948, what resulted out of the war was the total dismemberment of Palestine. Not only that 56% of the territory were controlled by the newly created state Israel. As a matter of fact, Israel took over 78% of Palestine. And the remaining part, to make the story even more interesting, so to speak, was divided between Jordan, on the one hand, took over the West Bank in fulfillment of earlier arrangements between King Abdullah of Jordan and Golda Meir, one of the Zionist leaders who later on became a prime minister. King Abdullah and Golda Meir used to meet in 1946 and 47, as we know from Golda Meir herself, from her book, The Story of My Life, and from our works. So, and on the other hand, Egypt took over the Gaza Strip. So in effect, there was really no room left whatsoever, even from the 22% of the land, to to create a Palestinian state or a real Arab state, as the partition resolution of 1947 stipulated. In other words, after the war, or as a result of the war, close to 800,000 Palestinians were driven out of their homes and property and became refugees, stateless, outside their country and within their own country. Over close to 500 Palestinian villages and towns were leveled and destroyed. And much of the territory of Palestine came under another rule, either Israeli, Egyptian, or Jordanian, and really nothing was left whatsoever for the Palestinians. And when you meet with elderly Palestinians today and ask them about their life, for example, under Jordanian rule in 1950s, they would tell you gruesome stories about how the Jordanian army used to absolutely quell and any attempted demonstration and to torture any activists from within Palestinian society. One of my uncles, Mark, was one of those who were imprisoned and actually tortured by the Jordanians due to suspicion that he was involved in, you know, national activities.
Well, of course, in those days, the Hashemite kingdom was attempting to consolidate its hold on East Jerusalem, on the West Bank. The Hashemite kingdom was attempting to become, in a sense, the Palestinian state, but not under Palestinian rule, under Hashemite and British rule. But, you know, there was a very major thing, and we shouldn't forget it, especially with our theme being, you know, to reflect on the history, the life and the death of the two-state solution. The international community immediately stepped forward, and it did so in the guise of Count Foch Bernadette, who was a very distinguished international diplomat who had, in fact, helped many Jewish refugees in Europe escape the gas chambers. And he was immediately dispatched to Palestine, representing the UN, the Security Council, the international community. His efforts were very extensive. He attempted a number of different plans at the time, including what would have to be called a variant of the two-state solution. And then, in the middle of his efforts, when it looked like he might be heading to some kind of success and even getting some of the Zionist leaders to agree with him, he was assassinated. You mentioned before the Irgun, the Sterngag. He was assassinated, and from my perspective, that kind of put a bullet in the two-state solution and the partition plan of that era.
I think this is well said, yes. The Count, you know, Count Bernadotte was killed, and, you know, he was assassinated, and indeed, his assassination was politically driven to wipe out an idea, to wipe out the possibility, indeed, of establishing another state, i.e. the Arab state. So this was the Nakba, this was the catastrophe for the Palestinians, in every sense of the term, territorially, nationally, socially. People were dispersed, so many people got killed and massacred. And now, you know, there are so many works that have uncovered the ferocity of what the Israeli army has done and the massacres they have committed against Palestinians during those years. So the territory was taken over, the society was really dealt the big blow, and the idea of a two-state solution, one more time, was liquidated. Israel was interested only in solidifying its own bases and in expanding its own boundaries without limits, as a matter of fact. And as one of the leaders of the first groups, Menachem Begin, who later on became a prime minister of Israel, said in his book, The Story of the Revolt of the Irgun, that without the massacre of Deir Yassin or in Deir Yassin, there wouldn't have been Israel. So he speaks proudly of his role in committing that massacre. And certainly that was not an isolated incident.
Now, what happened?
You can imagine what a catastrophe.
Yeah, go ahead.
You can imagine what a catastrophic, you know, set of consequences loomed over Palestinian society due to the Nakba and its aftermath. I mean, you know, people were truly, truly dispersed. They were driven out. You know, the violence myth that people left voluntarily is not only nonsensical, it's not only laughable, but it's an attempted cheap way, I think, of altering history. And, you know, every student of those years knows quite well that people were driven out by force, by psychological means, by an extensive machinery, a very sophisticated machinery of weaponry to occupy the country and to empty the land of its own indigenous population.
But the ramifications went beyond Palestine. The Arab world was, in a sense, defeated. The Arab world went into a funk. This led to the revolution in Egypt. King Farouk, that you mentioned, was discredited. It led to the army taking over. It led to Nasser's rise. The Hashemites were on a roll. They were being armed and financed by the Brits, and then the Americans were taking over. And then, a few years later, you had Israel's attempt to expand and maintain control and maybe bring down the Egyptian revolution, because the 56 war was a colonial plot largely between the European powers and Britain and France and Israel to take control of the Suez Canal, Nasser having given them the excuse that he was nationalizing it. And of course, that's when Eisenhower stepped in. And even back in Eisenhower's days, there was something I think called the Johnston Plan. They were going to use economic issues and water resources as a way to try to have some sort of coordination between Jordan and Israel. And I think the Arab League scotched that. They didn't want anything to do with it because they kind of smelled that this was not really in the interests of the Arabs and the Palestinians. It was kind of to make it possible for the Israelis to bring in more immigrants, as I recall. So what happened in the 50s? What happened to the two-state solution?
Oh, you know, it was gone. It was gone, really. Due to the dismay, I mean, due to the shock created by the Arab peoples in the Arab world at the performance of the Arab armies and the Arab, political systems, the Arab regimes, almost every Arab country went through upheavals after the 1948 defeat, after the 1948 catastrophe. Nasser of Egypt, who was an army officer who participated in the Palestine War in 1948, witnessed how ill-prepared the Egyptian army was, how ill-supervised and ill-directed, and he concluded that there was absolutely no genuine attempt by the regime to support the Palestinians. That was one of the reasons why he led the revolt, the Free Army officers against King Farouk, who was ousted in 1952. King Abdullah of Jordan was assassinated by a Palestinian in Jerusalem, actually at the Aqsa Mosque, also in protest of his performance during that war. Lebanon went through changes. There were constant changes taking place in Iraq, in Syria, and so on and so forth. But the 1950s, really, that was the decade of, deep sleep for the question of Palestine. The Palestinians were hardly able to really take any deep breath. The extent of the Nakba, the extent of the catastrophe was so severe to the extent that Palestinians really needed that time to try to recover on the personal level, on the social level, on the group level, and on the national level. People were dispersed. People who lived together all those years in their own paradise, as they say, found themselves each thrown in a different country, in a different locale, foreign to them, sure, in the Arab world, and in other parts of the world, but nonetheless, they lost their belongings. Some of them lost their children. They lost their homes. I mean, they were stateless. They lived in tents. So that period of the 50s, any Palestinian you talk to, was a decade of pain, severe pain, an attempted recovery, just to try to recover really from what they went through.
Well, Hisham,
Arab, I think, manipulated, exported that.
That was also the period. I've seen the pictures, and I'm sure you've even seen more of them, and that was the period when the tents that they had lived in 48, 49, 50, started getting converted into concrete blocks, and that was the period when the refugees camps started to be established. But if I recall, at the time, the UN had passed a resolution saying that the Palestinian refugees had the right to return. And even though they were demoralized, and even though they were settling into these camps in many countries, and I think they thought back then, sooner or later, they were going to get those rights that the UN had enshrined in Resolution 194, I think it is. Or were they not even focusing on that?
No, that's absolutely true. It is Resolution 194, which emphasized the right of the Palestinians to return, to their original owners and property, and or to receive compensation for the agonizing situation they went through. And that resolution has been repeated, or it has been re-emphasized numerous times, but it was never really put into effect. And you're right. From that year on, from 1948 on, still Palestinian refugees always have maintained the hope and the determination to return to their former homes and property. After all, they are the true owners of it. But what I'm saying is that the 1950s truly was a difficult decade that the Arab world has exploited to Arabize the question of Palestine. So in other words, not only that the country was dismembered, but the national identity, a distinct identity of Palestinianism, was under severe attack. The Egyptians, even Nasser, who is widely respected, was widely respected in the Arab world and among Palestinians, viewed himself as the supreme leader of the Arab world and also of the Palestinian movement. Certainly the Jordanians, the Hashemites, viewed themselves as the true owners, if you will, or controllers, at least the part of Palestine that they were given as a reward for their complicit effort in the war, i.e. the West Bank. So that was the decade of the Arabization of the question of Palestine to erase any distinct role for the Palestinians themselves, and that remained to be the case until the 1950s, until some active Palestinian students really took note of this official Arab regime effort and started planning independent of the Arab state system, to form or to plan for an independent Palestinian action. And this eventually led to the establishment of the PLO. Now, the story of the establishment of the PLO is an interesting story by itself, Mark.
Well, while the PLO was being established, we in America, I was, of course, a little kid in Minnesota then, as I've joked with you before, singing the Israeli national anthem at the end of the Passover Seder, and we were preoccupied with the Cold War. We were preoccupied with the possibility of a nuclear war with the Russians. Kennedy came to power. We were at the height of our American financial and political and growing military power. I don't recall any discussion in those years from Kennedy or LBJ of a two-state solution, but there was a lot of discussion of the importance of having strategic relations in the Middle East because of the Cold War. And that kind of brings us to the period you were just talking about, that students, Palestinian students, being educated, I think Arafat was educated in Kuwait, or he was working there as an engineer, I think, as a young engineer. Is that right?
Yeah, he was educated in Egypt and was working in Kuwait as an engineer. That is correct.
So they were creating the PLO. The Arab League was trying to control them and keep it under their tutelage. They were trying to become independent of it. The Americans were busy with the Cold War, busy with the Kennedy assassination, busy with worrying about nuclear weapons. And interesting, there's a little side note here. The Kennedy administration knew the Israelis were trying to build nuclear weapons, were terribly fearful this would lead to an arms race and an eventual nuclear war in the Middle East, that the Americans could be drawn into it, and that it would become part of the Cold War. And the Kennedy administration tried very, very hard to prevent the Israelis from becoming a nuclear power at that time, just as the Eisenhower administration had forced the Israelis back from what happened in 1956. So it was a very interesting period of time. Meanwhile, the Israelis were growing in power. They were outmaneuvering LBJ and then Kennedy. Outmaneuvering first Eisenhower and then Kennedy. And your movement, the PLO movement, was just taking off, but I don't think that early PLO movement had a two-state solution in mind. I don't think that was part of their either rhetoric or thinking. How did the two-state solution interact with the start of the PLO?
Oh, no, that's definitely true. Actually, the beginning of the establishment of the PLO are interesting, as I said, because it was the Arab state system that was interested in the creation of the PLO in order to send a mistaken image to the Palestinians that the Arab state system is concerned and that it is sincere about what is happening to Palestine. So interestingly enough, the first conference in May of 1964 that was held in Jerusalem, where the PLO establishment was declared, had the support of both King Hussein and Nasser of Egypt. And both of them, by the way, were utter rivals for a variety of reasons, partly ideological, partly national, partly personal. But anyway, each of them thought that they can contain Palestinian efforts and Palestinian attempted independent work. And even the first head of the PLO, Ahmed Shoukry, was closer to the Arab state system than he was to the Palestinians themselves. But certainly, the idea of the two states was not on the table for discussion at that time. And the PLO itself went through fundamental reform as nationalist movements, nationalist groups from Palestinian society took over the PLO. In 1965, Fatah was launched after Yasser Arafat, unconvinced of the inability of the Arab state system to stop an Israeli settlement project. The use or the control of the waterways of the Jordan River to boost that settlement project, he participated in a resistance act which detonated that settlement project, that waterway project. And that acquired Fatah a tremendous degree of support and, the beginnings of its credibility. Eventually, of course, the 67 war took place, the Six-Day War, as it is called, but from in Palestinian lexicon, it is really the Six-Hour War, in which the totality of Palestine came under Israeli occupation, including also Arab territory, the Sinai Peninsula from Egypt and the Golan Heights from Syria. So up until then, nobody was talking about a two-state solution or what have you. The PLO, of Fatah in particular, actually spoke of one state, a secular democratic state for all, irrespective of religion, in which everybody would be treated equally under the law and where all people would live harmoniously.
Well, that's right. The
and
big
that's
change
to be
the big change came with the 67 war, and we are still living through the ramifications of the 67 war. And the rebirth of the two-state solution came partly, in fact, to a considerable degree as a result of that. But that's for the next chapter, looking at what happened in 67, how it happened, and what the ramifications were.